millions pouring into gubernatorial campaign coffers, Mike Pence struggling to make the debate stage, plus a fight over a proposed medical privacy rule, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 21st, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, more than 9 months away from the GOP primary for Indiana's open governor's seat, the race is shaping up to be one of the most expensive in state history. More than $5 million flowed into campaign coffers in the first half of this year alone. U.S. Senator Mike Braun took in the biggest haul, more than $2 million. That's double what Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch brought in over the first half of 2023. Fort Wayne businessman Eric Doden wasn't far behind Braun, adding $1.8 million to his campaign account. But a third of Doden's fundraising total was a contribution from his father, and only about 150 individuals, businesses, and organizations donated to his campaign so far this year, compared to more than double that for Crouch and more than triple that for Braun. The spending hasn't truly begun in earnest yet. Doden has spent the most this year so far, and all three campaigns have directed much of their spending towards consulting and research. What do these fundraising numbers tell us about the state of the race? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Chris Mitchum. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, what from these numbers stands out to you?
Well, I think the first thing that stands out is just what a joke Indiana campaign finance laws are. I mean, the idea that anybody, even the father of a candidate, can donate $600,000 to a campaign is ridiculous. And when you take these numbers, which, you know, the numbers are impressive, but when you divide them up by the number of contributors or people putting money into this race, you're talking about an average campaign donation of between $3,000 and $4,000 apiece. Okay, this isn't being driven by what the voters want. This is an investment by the moneyed class in who's going to be the next governor, they think. And I bet you're going to find overlap in contributions to Crouch and to Braun from the same kind of people who are, they're investing in it. They're buying stock in who the next governor is to make sure that their phone calls get returned or what they think is important gets emphasized. And that's part of the problem with our finance laws. There are no limits. I mean, no effective limits in Indiana at all. And disclosure is virtually meaningless as well. It is a joke. It's something we ought to deal with. And I don't see a whit's difference in issues between these three campaigns. Okay, and
well,
I don't know
a lot of the issues.
Well, there's
these three
that. I don't see
yet,
it. They're out there.
Although it's still early.
And
for that.
I don't see the average voter getting all excited about any one of the three of them.
I want to talk a little bit about Eric Doden because, you know, we expected Braun to have money, some of which is his own, although not this particular reporting period. We expected Crouch to have money because she's been raising money with Eric Holcomb for 8 years, but. So, you know, a lot of eyes, I think, were on Doden for, can you keep up? He's more than keeping up. He's second the cycle, only 400,000 behind Braun. But coming from a much smaller pool of donors, is that a worrying sign for Doden's campaign?
Yeah, and I think to Ann's point about, you know, who's donating to who, I think you will see a lot of overlap with the Braun and Crouch. And do they spill over to Doden? You might see that more as the campaign progresses. If he just hangs around, continues to hang around, continues to actually preach the I'm the outsider message that was so effective for Braun last year, which I think at this point in the race, he's the only one that can truly have that message. I think that would be notable. And I think when it comes to, you know, the hedge continually being raised to, if you want to jump into this race, you know, this is the kind of money you're going to have to be playing with. I looked and I know it was completely different circumstances, a completely different, you know, opponents. But around this time in the last election cycle, I think Governor Holcomb had about like $6 million on hand. So whenever you take into account that's one candidate in the party, you have three separate ones that combined have almost doubled that. That makes you kind of realize just how much money and investment is going into this race. And if they continue to be on the same level, I think that continues to tell people that this is a wide open race between at least those three.
And yeah, and obviously, you know, money goes up. So obviously it's going to be more expensive than most races. But even adjusting for the usual inflation, this is a really expensive race.
Absolutely.
If you're
If you're Mike Braun, obviously you're pretty happy. You've got the most donors, you've got the most money at this stage, both raised in this period as well as cash on hand. If you're Suzanne Crouch, you raised half of what Mike Braun did. Are you concerned about those numbers?
The public pronouncement or the private pronouncement? Because they're probably different. Nobody wants to be trailing in the money race. It's not as important as the election that takes place when voters go to the polling place, but it's pretty darn important, especially when you have a race with high-profile candidates who are all well-funded and all have IOUs that they can collect from party members across the state. So everybody's trying to read the tea leaves, and money raised is certainly an indicator. The reason, the mitigator here is, this is not a situation where someone is, you know, struggling to get the message out, is trying to get it. We've seen that in a lot of elections where I if I could get on the air, if I could sustain, you know, carpet bombing in terms of messaging in all the major markets from now to Election Day, I could do something. Well, they can. They can all essentially do that.
Oh,
so,
no, they can't. Not yet.
Well,
not in Chicago.
Well, not yet, but they're going
right.
to, at some point, they're going to be
able
to start,
they're well positioned.
They're going to have a lot more than $2 million to do that.
Well, I'm talking in this final
stretch, but as we get further along, people, presumably, some people are holding back on giving because they want to see how they're also spending it, too.
You know.
And to that extent, don't forget that what was the term you used?
Playing
both sides or three
investing
sides. Certainly not a new thing. This is in the primary stage, but wait till the general and you'll see the same thing, nothing new. I mean, you have companies, you have prominent business people from both parties who hedge their bets and will give similar amounts to both candidates.
I want to ask a little bit about the spending because, we're not seeing the sort of spending necessarily in big numbers yet that the public sees, certainly. Some advertising, certainly from each campaign, particularly Doden, I noticed. And that makes the most sense because he's the lowest name recognition of the field at this point. But so much money being spent on consultants.
Yes,
what is that about?
I have decided I need to change my profession and be a consultant because overall, obviously, it's $5 million so far this year. I went back and looked, going back to when Doden started, added up all of them. We're at like $12.8 million already for this race. And they are spending it. And it's a lot of polling. It's a lot of consulting. I don't know what the consultants are telling them. I hope some of the consultants are saying you need to get out because there's too many people and you're splitting the vote. You need to think about what's going to happen. And we might get a new candidate soon.
No consultant that's being paid is advising his candidate to get out of the race. I can tell you that.
I think that's probably a safe bet.
Has anyone told the economic development folks that this is Indiana's fastest growing industry? Yes. Forget about biotech and forget about diesel or not diesel,
maybe
but
that
battery manufacturing.
Maybe the Leap District will just fill up with consulting firms. All right, Politico, speaking of money in politics, Politico reported this week that while six of the Republican presidential candidates are one small step away from qualifying for their party's debate next month, former Indiana Governor and Vice President Mike Pence isn't one of them.
The Republican National Committee debate qualifications are not an easy bar to clear. Candidates must have at least 40,000 unique donors, with 200 coming from at least 20 different states or territories, and they must poll at least 1% in three RNC-approved national polls, or in two such polls, plus two polls in early primary states. Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, Chris Christie, Nikki Haley, Vivek Ramaswamy, and Tim Scott are all within one state-level poll from qualifying for the August debate and appear almost certain to do so. And while Mike Pence still needs one more state-level poll, he also appears not to have reached the 40,000 donor threshold yet either.
Chris Mitchum, I'll be honest, I think I probably expect between now and late August that the debate actually is. I expect Mike Pence to reach the thresholds he needs to reach.
Me as well.
But is it a bad sign that he's right now failing on the donor front?
Yeah, it's not the greatest. And really, I think a lot of it can be put on to him for even announcing so late whenever most everybody in America knew he was going to throw his hat in the ring. Why'd you wait so long? I'm not so sure. But I do think time is a factor of if he would have announced a month or two earlier, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. I think the initial push of donors you get when you announce, and then the trickle that you get after that, knowing that everybody knows you're now a horse in the race, probably would have put him at the position where we wouldn't be having this conversation. And even then, don't get me wrong, I think if things fall out and he's not a member of this latest debate, that will certainly hurt his chances, but I'm not so sure that would completely eliminate him from the race, simply from the fact that if you look at every national average poll, he's running third behind, obviously, Trump and DeSantis. And these elections now, they're no longer the let me take my 5 minutes to share my view to the American people. It's now a smackdown, drag them out, you know, survival of the fittest of make sure you don't say anything that ends your campaign right there.
And heck, that's if Trump even shows up to that first debate, which
is true.
Is yeah. up in the air at this point.
And you saw him miss one, and obviously yeah. he's a different animal. But
yeah. With Mike Pence, are you, if you're advising Mike Pence, which I don't think would ever be something
I've that
happens.
I've done that, actually.
Opposition research is needed.
If that's true.
You read the book, right?
If you're advising Mike Pence, are you telling him to be a little concerned about where he's at right now?
I don't think Mike Pence can get the Republican nomination under any set of circumstances. I mean, he had the chance. He did the right thing on January 6th, okay? He did the right thing, but he obviously never read Profiles in Courage, because when you do the right thing and you carry it through, you're saying politics is not as important. He tried to straddle it. He tried to do what he knew he was legally obligated by the law to do, and that was to certify Joe Biden as president. But then he tried to backtrack and say he wasn't willing to criticize Trump. He wasn't willing, you know, he tried to have a foot in each kind of camp. And that makes him unappealing to too many people. I mean, I know he's appealing to the evangelical Christians. Okay, all right. But that's not a large enough group, even in the Republican Party, to get the nomination. And he's managed to irritate those who wanted him to stand up as a badge of courage and say, this isn't our party. This isn't what we stand for. And he wouldn't do that. He had a chance to go down in history, and he gave it up. And I don't think he can get the nomination.
In terms of getting to the debate, I agree with Chris that debates are not what they once were, certainly. And I think a lot of that changed with Trump. But realistically, they can make or more likely break a campaign. We've seen that. We saw that with Trump in 2016. So in the sort of debate we expect, whether Trump is involved or not, is that a great venue for Mike Pence to be in?
I mean, obviously, I think he would do fine in a debate, but I think that people like Chris Christie or Ron DeSantis, I mean, they are so much more forceful and
willing to
exactly,
go down to the level that Trump sort
exactly,
of established.
That I think they'll steal the show no matter what yeah. if they get on a stage with Trump, which I'm not sure will ever occur.
Yeah.
I also don't buy the – I'm not sure I'm convinced that if he had gotten in a month before, it'd be fine. I mean, he got in about the same time as Chris Christie did, you know, not too far after a couple
Tim
of others.
Scott,
so,
Tim Scott around the
I mean,
time.
They all kind of got in within a couple weeks of each other, and they've managed to hit the numbers that they need to. So,
yeah, again –
I think you're right about Chris Christie. I think if even if Trump's on the stage, I think he's going to dominate.
Absolutely.
And Mike Pence is going to be, if he makes it, would be an also-ran.
Well, and here's the problem.
And so Scott.
And here's arguably the problem for Mike Pence, too, with bringing up Chris Christie. You know, DeSantis is not playing the Trump was wrong. He's not playing that. I'm a better version
yeah.
of Donald Trump.
Yeah, you're not getting that
ways.
From Chris Christie.
No, Chris Christie is... Trump was wrong. I am, you know, standing in opposition to that.
Which is what Pence
which is
should
what,
have done.
When, and Pence kind of leans in that.
Ah,
he kind of leans.
Forth.
He goes back and forth. But isn't that a problem for Pence? He's not going to win the Trump wing, and he isn't firmly on the side that's going to win the anti-Trump wing that Christie is now occupying. So we talk a lot. We've talked a lot in the recent weeks about what's the lane, what's the path. What is Mike Pence's lane here?
Well, I think that's the problem. It's muddled because he has tried to straddle several lanes and swim or run, use your sports metaphor, in several lanes, hoping that, you know, he could winnow his choices and pick one when the time came. You know, it's modern-day politics are not kind to candidates like Mike Pence. I think a debate... maybe 3, 4, 5 cycles ago, he's a great debater. He's a good communicator. Nobody, I mean...
Yeah. He's a radio host.
That's what he did,
yeah.
He was a television host, the whole thing. So it's not as if he's inadequate in that area. And he can debate in sort of the Lincoln-Douglas style. But what these debates have evolved into is more political theater. And you use the term, I think, about the slap down. It's more
professional. Knock down, smack down.
Yeah, it's more smack. Professional wrestling. And with the crowd, even though, you know, I can hear it now, the moderator saying, please, we've asked that there be. Yeah. No, everybody's going to try to stack the room, as we saw with CNN's town hall meeting. Yep. And you can barely hear the questions and because of the catcalls and so forth. And that doesn't play to Mike Pence's strengths.
Or so, to a TV audience for that.
Well, it's just a different political landscape
reality,
now.
Yeah,
and that's just...
Yeah,
I don't know if that's a good thing, bad thing. It's just different.
It is what it is.
His goal in a debate and in this race should be, I am the cool, calm, collected one that's going to talk about policy and not rile you up about all of these cultural issues
the
everybody's talking about.
Yeah, the
which
does,
but that's,
and
that, but that's not effective. It's not,
no,
it's
but,
not effective.
And that,
most
that
presidential.
Is not
that's probably
primary.
The lane, though.
That's right.
That's the lane.
And hoping,
that may be the lane in November. I'm not sure that's the lane to the nomination.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, does Mike Pence have a realistic shot at the 2024 Republican nomination for president? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, who should be the Republican candidate for governor? Now, we got more than double the amount of votes we normally get in a poll. 6% said Mike Braun, 23% said Suzanne Crouch, 9% said Eric Doden, 44% said Curtis Hill, and 18% said someone else. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. In a recent letter, a group of state attorneys general, including Indiana's Todd Rokita, oppose a potential federal rule that would shield the private health information of people who access abortion in states where abortion is legal. Abortion rights advocates decry that letter as a disgusting overreach designed to scare and intimidate. Current federal medical privacy rules allow private information to be shared with law enforcement and government agencies for investigating possible violations of state laws or for the protection of public health. A proposed change by the Biden administration would shield patients' information, even from law enforcement, when it relates to reproductive health care in states where abortion is legal. 19 attorneys general say that proposal is based on fear-mongering, since no states that outlaw or heavily restrict abortion access penalize people who seek abortions. But abortion rights advocates question why state attorneys general would want access to patients' private health information if they weren't planning on prosecuting them. They argue the goal is to scare patients from seeking abortions, even when legal. John Schwanis, why would Todd Rokita want access to this particular private health information?
Wild guess. I mean, here's a man who has shown time and again that he's opposed to abortion almost under any circumstances. He's drawn that line in the sand. That's been one of his calling cards as a office holder. So, of course, you want access to that information, maybe to identify, maybe to make sure it's...
How about to intimidate?
Well, I'll just say to ensure that people are aware that others are watching. We just talked about how the rules have changed. Another example, how everything has changed. You know, there was a time when Republicans especially were saying, you know, don't get anybody between the doctor and patient. You know,
this more than that, how about the government wanting my private information?
Well, that's right. Okay, well, the two things come together here in a notion that Big Brother stay away. Now this is apparently flipped to the point that Big Brother's bad on financial matters, on, you know, releasing toxins, any number of things that you might do as a company or business. But if it's about your private medical, especially if it's about reproductive rights, well, then we need to have Big Brother there front and center.
Here's what I'm struggling with this is if a person in Indiana where come 2 weeks from now abortion is largely illegal, if a person from Indiana goes to Illinois, where abortion is largely legal, receives abortion care, and comes back to Indiana, they have broken no state laws. So why does Todd Rokita think he can investigate that?
The out-of-state thing is obviously the problem. The fact is there are exceptions to HIPAA in which prosecutors, police, attorney generals can get access to records. I do want to point out, it's not unfettered. A judge has to approve of that subpoena for those records. Whether a judge would, like you just say, what law are you investigating in Illinois, you know? But the fact that it's like both sides are pre-positioning to get this. Obviously, in-state, I feel like he and other attorneys general have that right to go through the process and try to prove their case.
But the rule wouldn't
out
affect
of
that.
State,
yeah, the rule wouldn't affect that.
The rules only affect accessing health information from the states where abortion is largely legal.
Right.
And so
there's only one reason to do it, okay? And that's to try to intimidate both the women seeking abortions and the doctors performing them. That's all it is. He has very weak prosecutorial powers in this state. Very weak. But
None,
what he has,
as
most do, but as what he does is use the power of his office to scare and intimidate people. He does it with doctors. He's now doing it with businesses. Now he wants to get the same guy who was all worked up about a 10-year-old's identity, which was never revealed, okay, now wants to know the names of people who are legally getting the same kind of legal medical attention that that 10-year-old got. It is a complete flip-flop, and it's done, again, to scare and intimidate. He abuses that office, and I hope the Supreme Court takes his license away.
We're going to go back to the point I asked John about, which is the idea of it felt like there was a time when Republicans would have been pretty angry at the idea of a state of elected official wanting access to private health information when it didn't seem obvious that that official would need it. But because this is abortion, do Republicans just not care?
Yeah, I think abortion kind of forces a lot of people to come out of the woodwork either one way or the other, whether you're on a Republican side or a Democrat side. And I think kind of going back to Rakita in particular, you have to remember this is not necessarily a charge led by him. He's signed on with, I think, 14 other attorney generals.
18
other attorney generals. I think it was mainly originally in Mississippi.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the question they're asking now is, you know, it's nothing new that abortion regulations, restrictions are around the country. Obviously, with Dobbs, it changes a lot of it. So I think a lot of their question is, why now? And I understand, you know, the new overscaping landscape of abortion regulations in the country. But you're also talking about a lot of really broad definitions in that rule. I think a lot of it is, yes, they are talking about, you know, the abortion in particular, but a lot of the requests in the letter as well was, let's reel it in, and are we actually talking about abortion in specifically or reproductive rights
It's a very broad definition.
Operations.
You want to compare, just
like
substitute COVID vaccine for abortion. No,
you're right.
Can you imagine if somebody said, we want everybody in the state, because it's in the public interest, to know who has sought treatment, who has been hospitalized? Can you imagine? I mean, we did see what happened when public health tried to push the issue of accountability on the part of individuals. It's hard juxtaposition.
And all that kind of stuff, yeah.
All right. Speaking of the governor's race, and Nikki mentioned there might be another candidate soon, well, Indiana Secretary of Commerce Brad Chambers announced this week he will soon step down after 2 years leading the state's economic development arm. Chambers oversaw a major shift in how the state pursues significant business investments.
Chambers signed a 2-year contract in 2021 to lead the Indiana Economic Development Corporation after 3 decades running a real estate firm. During his time at IEDC, the agency began pursuing economic development deals by spending hundreds of millions of dollars on site readiness, basically buying up land and helping prep it for new companies to move in and build more quickly. That policy has met with some mixed reaction, but over the last 2 years, the state has also secured some of the largest, most advanced economic development commitments in its history. Chambers' departure fuels growing speculation that he will run in the Republican primary for the open governor's seat. That primary already includes a former IEDC leader, Eric Doden, as well as U.S. Senator Mike Braun, Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch, and former Attorney General Curtis Hill.
Nikki Kelly does, well, we know who Ann's supporting for the Republican nomination. Nikki Kelly, does a Brad Chambers run for governor make sense to you?
You know, I'm really trying to figure it out. I mean, he and Doden are essentially kind of the same
candidate
person
profile.
With the same.
Yeah,
exactly. And so I don't know much about Brad Chambers. He's been very hesitant to be open with the media, with interviews and things like that. So maybe he has a lane I'm unaware of. Maybe he has ideas and proposals I don't know about. I look forward to hearing them. But on paper, I don't get it.
If you're Brad Chambers, now we don't know what kind of maybe personal wealth you might have, which can make a difference in a campaign. But if you're Brad Chambers and you just looked at the numbers we talked about at the top of the show, what about getting into that race at this stage is appealing to you?
Well, it wouldn't be a shovel-ready campaign. Let's put it that way. In allusion, of course, to what he has done in creating sort of a landscape, figuratively and literally, where companies can come in and have presumably a lot of the red tape taken care of and a lot of the infrastructure taken care of. Yeah, from that standpoint, it's one would question. I don't know what kind of personal wherewithal he has. He certainly has been at the levers of big decision-making and power, which I presume has made him visible with an important constituency. But to Nikki's point, that operating sort of behind the scenes, behind the curtain, levers, isn't necessarily the same skill set as being pounded by opposition research, by media questions. It may not be friendly, et cetera, et cetera.
Very, very briefly, is it safe to say, though, that Brad Chambers has had the most impactful tenure as a Secretary of Commerce in at least recent history in the state of Indiana?
Yeah, he certainly rocked the boat. And I even talked to a couple legislators last week about, you know, how did this $20 million increase to the IEDC budget happen in the last session? And they just said Chambers was the head of it, but they went and talked to every single individual legislator, whether the small groups or individual. They had paperwork, they had their pamphlets, they laid out the evidence of why they needed this.
Right.
And that's a good amount of work for me. I mean,
it'd be good to hear from how that money's been spent and why. Yeah.
All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Chris Mitchum, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.